And there's a great performance now on Radio 3. It's 6 o'clock and it's time for Opera on 3. As part of the BBC Opera season, Radio 3 is broadcasting all 7 of the operas featured in a new exhibition at the V&A. It's called Opera, Passion, Power and Politics, and it explores the stories behind 7 operatic premieres in 7 cities. It's an immersive exhibition presented in partnership with the Royal Opera House that takes you on a fascinating journey through nearly 400 years of history. We start the cycle at the Venice Carnival, for which Monteverdi wrote his last opera, L'Incoronazione di Poppea, a classical story of scandal, murder and ambition, which mirrors the decadent life of the city. The performance we're about to hear was recorded earlier this year at the Schwetzingen Festival in Germany. It's introduced by Andrew McGregor.
It's Monteverdi's last great opera, premiered during the Venice Carnival season in 1643. Il Nerone, ossia L'Incoronazione di Poppea, that's the full title, Nero, or The Coronation of Poppea, one of the first operas to use historical events to give it shape. And we're going to hear it in the performance given by La Veneziana, directed by Davide Pozzi at this year's Schwetzingen Festival in Germany, with mezzo Giuseppina Bridelli as the Emperor Nero and soprano Emanuela Galli as Poppea, and their adulterous love affair propels the plot. But nothing about this opera, its history or its performance is as simple as it may seem at first glance, which is why I'm joined by musicologist and Baroque specialist Dr. Hannah French. Now, Hannah, we'll get to some of the issues of authenticity, editions, manuscripts and performance practice a bit later on. But let's begin by giving Monteverdi's Poppea some basic operatic context. Where are we exactly? Because we're in the last year of Monteverdi's life, 1643. But what stage is this fledgling art form at by now?
Well, we've come a long way since Orfeo at the beginning of the century.
Because that was over 30 years before,
absolutely,
wasn't it?
Absolutely. So this is mature Monteverdi, if indeed it is Monteverdi. And as you we'll say, we will come back to that. Crucially, we're in Venice. And crucially, Venice is new to opera. The first public opera houses opened in 1637. So now we have a paying public who have an appetite mostly for mythology, for flying machines, for all the pyrotechnics and the colour of opera. So Monteverdi, or whoever, really bowls them a googly with this one.
Because we need to remind ourselves, this is a drama per musica, previously the province of the princes, the nobles. This was music for the private courts.
Right.
And it's now a business.
It is.
It's now money-making.
It is. And therefore, you have to satisfy the tastes of your new patrons. And these new patrons, I suppose, lots of men and their mistresses who might have their feathers ruffled by these morality tales, or amorality tales, as we have here.
And the libretto, it's by Giovan Francesco Busanello, a sophisticated writer from what I could tell. What was the big picture underlying his treatment of the historical story?
He takes his cue from Roman history. Tacitus and his Annals of History is the main source, but then he brings in other histories as well. And it's a focus on human beings. What he actually comes up with is not strictly true to the historical sources. You could say it's really a work of fiction, but it's based on the characters that the audiences would have known. So this is a tale where love finds victory over fortune, and they could be expecting that. But it's also a tale where love finds victory over virtue, and that's perhaps not what anybody was expecting.
Well, you already hinted at that, because at first glance, the morals of the lead characters don't stand up to scrutiny, do they? Nero and Poppea aren't exactly the most virtuous couple. You said morality play, then amorality play. Some people would go directly for immorality. Yes. But what makes them attractive characters? Because the opera's effectively glorifying greed, lust and ambition.
It is. It's this complex web of morally compromised characters. And actually, I think what makes it fascinating and seductive is the music. However cynical the libretto might be at times, the music makes it human, and you find yourself identifying with them, and then that makes you feel a little oddly about yourself.
And the fact that it's actually carnival in Venice, does that mean that there is a more relaxed sense of morality anyway because of the way people are behaving, because of the masks, because of the nature of the entertainment and
Absolutely.
All of the drinking?
So the last hurrah before Lent, and you have your mask on, you have that chance to step outside your usual way of living, perhaps.
And is there a central moral dilemma underpinning the drama? Because it's not utterly straightforward to unpick, is it?
It's not. Nothing is ever as it might seem. Poppea, Yes, some people see her as the ultimate courtesan. And of course, Venice was a destination for courtesans. But the role of women within that society was very different to the role of women in courts, even fairly nearby. And really, the thing that underpins this opera is the fact that women had to be wily to get on in this man's world. And whether that was the right thing or the wrong thing to do at any of these points, you can see it as an allegory for society as well as that. Perhaps also a warning to the Republic, because they saw themselves as having this liberty despite being within the autocratic rule of the popes. They took the moral high ground, perhaps, but, you know, the shenanigans that could go on right at the top might be a warning to society too.
And Poppaea's fascinating, isn't she? Because she's beautiful, she's seductive, but she's crafty and wily, powerful, ambitious, ruthless in her way. And the way in which she climbs to the position of empress is celebrated, as we'll hear, by her nurse.
Yes, it is. And I think what you have to do is be able to separate out love from ambition. She speaks of love when she's with Nero the whole time, and you feel like you're in no doubt that she's in love with him. But then as soon as she's away from him, talking to anybody else or to herself or even to the god of love, she's talking about ambition. She's talking about reaching that throne. She's not talking about how she feels about Nero on a personal level.
30 years on from Monteverdi's Orfeo, if we think about the musical depiction of the characters, has it become a lot more sophisticated?
Yes, it has. When we have Orfeo, we have recitatives, and when we have arias, we know they're singing. The characters know they're singing. Now we have so much more sophistication in the rhetorical language. You know, even down to the devices such as love being in triple time, arpeggios being for conflicts. We have duets now in which the text is overlaid and it really heightens the sense either of sexual tension or of discord. When we have the stile concertato, we know what's going on with the idea of rage or war or those inner passions bubbling over. Chromaticism, you know, they're sneaking along. You know, are we really rooting for Seneca or are we being cynical about him? These are sophistications within the music which the audience would identify with beyond narration and storytelling.
Well, thanks, Anna. We're going to talk more about the genesis of the opera after we've heard the first act. And if you go to the Opera on Three website, you'll find a full cast list and synopsis. But before Act One, there's the prologue. So what's the function of it at this stage of the genre of Italian opera?
Well, it's a conventional way of having a kind of allegorical précis of the action that's to follow. So virtue and fortune debate who's the most powerful until love, i.e. Cupid, arrives and proves that he is the strongest of all.
And Cupid tells them that once they've heard the story that follows, they'll have to admit that he's the strongest. Right, that's the prologue. Cue Act 1. We're in Imperial Rome, around AD 60, and at dawn beside Poppaea's villa, Ottone sings of Poppaea's beauty and his love for her. But when he sees that Nero's soldiers are stationed around the villa, he realises the emperor must be inside and that Poppaea has betrayed him while he's been away. The guards wake, cursing Nero's adulterous behaviour, and inside, after a night of passion, Nero and Poppaea say their farewells. After he's left, she makes no secret of her ambition to be Empress of Rome, but her nurse, Arnalta, warns Poppaea of the dangers of tangling with the most powerful man on earth. Meanwhile, at the Imperial Palace, Empress Octavia is distraught at her husband's adultery and angrily rejects the suggestion that she takes a lover of her own. Octavia asks the philosopher Seneca to plead on her behalf to the Senate and the people, and she leaves to pray at the temple. Seneca is visited by the goddess Pallas Athene, who warns him of his impending death. Nero returns and confides in Seneca that he intends to marry Poppaea. Poppaea lies to Nero that Seneca is claiming to be the power behind the throne. Nero promises to make her empress and decrees that Seneca must pay with his life. Ottone now tries to patch things up with Poppaea, but she rejects him. She's Nero's now. Drusilla, a lady-in-waiting, is in love with Ottone and he promises to marry her, but after she leaves, delighted, he confides that he's still in love with Poppaea. So here's La Veneziana, directed from the harpsichord by Davide Pozzi, in the prologue and first act of Monteverdi's The Coronation of Poppaea. Thank you.
L'Armenia si rivela e te non ci pensi. La Polonia, allarmi, allarmi, hey, hey, sereni. Così per quanto vecchio l'impero se ne va di mare in peggio. Di pur che il prence nostro ruba tutti per donare ad alcuni, l'innocenza v'afflitta e scelerati stan sempre a man dritta. Sol del pedante Seneca si fida. Di quel vecchio rapace,
di quel volpon sagace,
di quel reo partigiano che fonda il suo guadagno sul tradire il compagno,
di quell'empio architetto che si fa casa sul sepolcro altrui.
Non ridir, non ridir quel che diciamo, il fidarti va scaltro se gli occhi non si fidano l'un dell'altro. Però nel guardar van sempre insieme.
Impariamo, impariamo dagli occhi.
Impariamo, impariamo dagli occhi a non trattar da scemi.
Impariamo. A non trattar da sciocchi.
Impariamo,
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 impariamo dagli occhi a non trattar da sciocchi.
Ma già si imbianca l'alba e viene il dì. Tacciam, tacciam,
nero, nero.
Nerone, Nerone,
Nerone, Nerone,
taccia, 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 Nerone qui.
Sostieni che queste braccia ti circondino il collo come le tue bellezze circondano il cuore mio. Poppea! Lascia che io parta, non partire, non partire, signore, temo il partire. Appena spunta l'alba, e tu che sei l'incarnato mio sole, e la mia palpabile,
Thank you. fausto ne prometti
e giuro e me lo osserverai e se avverrò tu me verrai
e me lo osserverai
e se avverrò tu me verrai
penetrati di nerogli amori onde temo e momento, che ogni giorno, che ogni punto sia di tua vita. Il giorno e il punto estremo. Pratica coi regi è perigliosa, l'amor e l'odio non han forza in essi, sono gli affetti lor pur interessi. Se ne lontana cortesia, se t'abbandona non te puoi dolere, per minor mal ti converrà tacere.
Ma non temo, no, non temo, no, non ancora, no, non temo, non temo di ancora.
Grande spira onor con la presenza, lascia mentre la casa empie di vento, reputazione e fumo e pagamento. Perdi l'onor con dir Neron mi gode, sono inutili vizi ambiziosi, mi piaccion più i peccati fruttuosi. Con lui tu non puoi mai trattar del pari, e se le nozze hai per oggetto e fine, mendicando tu vai le tue rovine.
Ma non temo, non temo di nulla.
Mira, mira, Poppea, dove il prato è più ameno e dilettoso, stassi il serpente ascoso, de casi le vicende son funeste, la calma è profezia delle tempeste, delle tempeste, delle tempeste. Ben sei pazza, ben sei pazza, se credi che ti possano far contenta e salva un garzon cieco ed una donna calva. Ben sei pazza, se credi.
Disprezzata regina, penso che penso. Delle donne miserabile sesso, se la natura il cielo libri ci produce il matrimonio, ci incatena sempre. Se concepiamo l'uomo, delle donne miserabile sesso, allo strempio diran formiam le membra, allattiamo il carnefice e ci cogliere e ci scarne e ci svena, e siam costrette, siam costrette per indegna sorte a noi medesime partorir la morte.
Se l'ingiuria Neron tanto ti piacerto ancor. Happy, happy, piacerto ancor nel far vendetta.
imperatrice, sovra titoli eccelsi degli insignavi tuoi, cospicua e grande la vanità del pianto degli occhi imperiali e ufficio indegno. Ringrazia, ringrazia la fortuna che con i colpi suoi t'accresce gli ornamenti, la cote non percossa, non percossa, non può mandar faville. Tu dal destin colpita, dal destin colpito, produce a te medesma alti splendori di vigor, di fortezza, glorie maggiori assai che la
canzoni. Almeno te stessa è la tua fama.
Trarrò la lingua a chi vorrà biasmarmi.
Più muti che farai, più parleranno.
Ottavia, è infrigidita ed infeconda.
Chi ragione non ha, cerca pretesti.
Ma che può, ciò che vuole ragione non manca.
Manca la sicurezza all'opera ingiuste.
Sarà sempre più giusto il più potente.
Ma chi non sa regnar, sempre può meno.
La forza
La forza, la forza, accende il chiodo.
Mi sono di quella.
E turba il sangue, turba il sangue.
Il bisogno non ho della ragione.
La ragione regge gli uomini di dei.
Tu. Mi sforzo lo stesso. Allo segno. A tuo dispetto. Siano giuste o ingiuste le mie moglie. Oggi, Pompea, sarà mia moglie.
Thank you.
Thank you. feci di pazzia.
È questo del mio amore in cui d'errore.
Modestia, ma...
è questo del mio amore in cui d'errore.
Ora, non più.
È questo del mio amore in cui d'errore.
Non più, non più. Son di Nerone.
Ai, ai, che si vida in un bel volto, in un bel volto. Fabbrica in aria, fabbrica in aria e sopra, sopra il tuo fondo. Vento al mare il vento, il vento, ed immobile, immobile, afferma il fumo e l'onda, sesso non ha per sua natura altro domani in sé che la figura. Mio cor, torna, torna in te stesso. Ella pensa al comando, e se ci arriva, se ci arriva, la mia vita è perduta. Otton, torna, torna in te stesso. A questo fine dunque arrivar dovea l'amor tuo, perfidissima, perfidissima Poppea.
Il tribunal d'amor con la giustizia fa, di me non hai pietà, altresì ride con del tuo.
Io son bellissima donzella, or vol libero d'un, ad altri mi rivolgo, e son
She calms the tumult in my heart. Atone will belong to Drusilla, yet Drusilla is on my lips, but Poppaea is in my heart. The voice of Atone, unable to get over his betrayal by the beautiful Poppaea, who's now involved in an adulterous affair with Emperor Nero and determined to become Empress of Rome. The end of the first act of Monteverdi's opera, The Coronation of Poppaea, in this performance from Germany's Schwetzingen Festival in May this year. You heard soprano Emanuela Galli as Poppaea, mezzo Giuseppina Bridelli as Nero, mezzo Xenia Meyer as Empress Octavia, bass Salvo Vitale as Seneca, countertenor Raffaele Pei as Ottone, and soprano Silvia Rosato as Drusilla. And she also sang the part of Fortune in the prologue, alongside soprano Vittoria Giacobazzi as Virtue and soprano Lucia Cortese as Cupid, Amore. Arnalto was sung by tenor Alberto Allegrezza, and the two Roman soldiers guarding Poppaea's villa were Massimo Altieri and Riccardo Pisani, with the ensemble La Veneziana, directed from the harpsichord by Davide Pozzi. Well, Act Two follows in a few minutes, but Hannah French, before we plunge back into the adulterous, morally questionable action, there are a few questions to attempt to answer about the genesis of the opera itself. Do we even know it's by Monteverdi?
No. There's no mention by any of his contemporaries that he wrote Poppaea, which is odd and tricky. There's no surviving score that originally had his name on it.
So we don't have a manuscript, do we?
No. There are two manuscripts, one which was found in Venice and one from Naples, both representing revivals of the opera from the 1650s, so after Monteverdi's death. His name was added later to that Venice manuscript. So that is something. And it's also on the manuscript libretto from Venice too. So there is evidence that his name was associated with this work, but when it comes to the actual dots on the page, we just can't be 100% sure.
Because one of those versions is strongly associated with Cavalli. Is it in his hand?
Yes, in fact, his wife's hand.
His wife's
so
hand,
his
right.
Wife,
so
wrote
from
out,
his collection.
Exactly. His wife wrote out Acts 1 and 3, and Anon wrote out Act 2. But he, Cavalli, his handwriting's all over it. Cuts, revisions, and additional ritornelli and that kind of thing.
So there's a strong suggestion that he might have been responsible for some of Poppaea.
Yes.
And there's this theory that it's, well, shall we say, school of Monteverdi,
right,
that several composers worked on it, and it's a collaborative exercise.
Perhaps the workshop of Monteverdi. I mean, he would only need to have perhaps given an outline, some of the music, that kind of thing, for it to be posthumously attributed to him. It would give it prominence, it would give it weight, where perhaps these younger composers were just still up and coming. Names to bat around, Filiberto Lorenzi, Benedetto Ferrari, Francesco Manelli, Francesco Sacrati, and Francesco Cavalli. Francesco is obviously popular in opera. But, you know, these are all of the Monteverdian school. And yes, a compendium, perhaps, or perhaps it was their interpretation of his first version.
So they could almost have been a sort of collaborative amanuensis for Monteverdi.
Well, he was very elderly by this point, perhaps infirm, and perhaps needed that backup team. And also, at the time, it wouldn't have raised as many eyebrows and been as difficult as it is for us now, for audiences or future revivals, had there been any, to accept that it had been a collaborative work.
And in terms of contemporary scholarship, what's the general feeling? Because I know about all of these ideas that it's gone one way, gone the other way, people identifying different composers' potential fingerprints in different parts of the score. But at the moment, are people thinking that it is justifiable to say Monteverdi's Poppea? Because in some ways it's such a high-quality work in terms of the sense of colour and drama and the huge personality that's obviously behind it. Does it feel to contemporary scholars as though there is this single elderly individual composer behind the whole thing?
I think they go either way. So I think some do, and they're very happy for that. And really, Monteverdi's reputation, lasting reputation as a mature operatic writer, rests a lot on this. So it's become, history's been very kind to him in that respect, and it has become Monteverdi's latest, greatest work. Others would just say, no, it really isn't. He has the outline, he has the ideas, and then others took it forward. And the more you pick about with it, the more you see that perhaps the moments, like the chorus saying to Seneca, don't die, Seneca, don't do this. You know, it looks like it's come from Book 7 of the Madrigals. But then the more you look at it, perhaps actually it's an homage to that. Perhaps it's a pastiche composition by one of his ardent followers. It's tricky.
And we've got to remember, it's a business, as we said earlier. Was this possibly the product of some kind of commercial opera factory for the Venice Carnival? Does that sort of have any possible
relevancy? It's an interesting concept, something that they were very keen to have Monteverdi's hand in, even if he couldn't provide the whole thing.
And the appetite of the Venice Carnival for new operas and entertainments and adventurous productions, that's also a vital part of this, isn't it?
It is. Monteverdi had this view that the music of an opera was inseparable from its poetry and its drama. And actually, the tastes that were driving the market in Venice were set to reverse that. They relished the kind of the visual elements, the sets and the costumes and the musical elaboration in compelling the dramatic structure, which created this atmosphere and then rivalries between different opera companies and about the rising stars themselves and that kind of thing. And actually, Poppea stands out as being a work that preceded that, and it really glows for that reason.
Now, we're going to talk a little bit about performance practice and style a little bit later, but just briefly, how much license do the performers have, La Veneziana? And what's set in stone? What's fuzzy? What's optional? What's unknown?
So much is unknown. So much is unknown. And depending on whether we use the Naples version or the Venetian version, we then have either four or three parts for any of the instrumental writing. So it's ambiguous. What we actually have is a vocal line, and then we have a continuo line. The idea really is to have this monster continuo team, so you have so many options as to how you might colour the text. And of course, the text is sacred. It's perhaps the only thing that's sacred in the whole opera. And Monteverdi's treatment of it is such that the role of the performers is to highlight and illustrate that text with their choice of instruments. So lots and lots of options to be had.
So what sort of decisions have La Veneziana taken with this? What can we hear?
So things to listen out for is the timbral differences. So when Nero is proclaiming a decree, we get the very austere organ with a lute or a chitarrone. And then when we have somebody kind of titivating, then we might have a harpsichord or some plucked strings. So the idea is a real textural difference. But the brilliance of this particular performance is how this creates such momentum, and it's seamless.
I want to go back to these two different manuscripts that have survived, neither in Monteverdi's hand, neither autograph ones, rediscovered in the 1880s and the 1920s, and they were from different revivals of Poppaea. So what's the contemporary view of how to reconcile them? And what do we hear in La Veneziana's performance? How have they navigated between these two sources?
So there are substantial differences between the two. Sections, some are in one, not in the other, that kind of thing. Act three, Ottavia's farewell to Rome and Anata's triumphant songs can be switched between the two. And we mentioned earlier the Ritornelli and the Sinfonia. In Venice, it's in three parts. In Naples, it's in four parts. Some productions come down in favour of one over the other. The Naples one, as we mentioned before, is a little bit more difficult because we know that the Febi Armonici, the touring opera company, revived it. In fact, they performed it in a royal tennis court that had been set up for opera instead. But the actual score itself doesn't show any of the detail of this because it is so pristine, yeah. Clearly wasn't used. Whereas the Venetian one shows all of the trappings of different performances or perhaps changes through rehearsals, and it's a real working manuscript. People usually make some kind of combination of both. But what La Veneziana tend to do is come down on the Naples side and use that actually as their starting point and then make those corrections, the little snips here and there, add in ritornellos, that kind of thing to make it work, which you could well imagine would have been the practical outcome of using that score.
Well, it's fascinating, and there are so many imaginative decisions that have to be made, as we'll be hearing as we go through it. Thanks, Hannah. We'll talk a bit more between the second and third acts about changing style and performance practice over the last 30 or 40 years. But we left Emperor Nero and Poppaea in the middle of their adulterous affair, with him planning to replace the Empress with Poppaea and kill his elderly tutor, the philosopher Seneca. Well, Poppaea has shown her naked ambition for power and influence, while her spurned lover Ottone has promised himself to the noblewoman Drusilla, although his heart is still very much with Poppaea. And don't forget that you'll find a full cast list and synopsis on the Opera on 3 website. Well, as Pallas Athene promised, Mercury the winged messenger arrives at Seneca's villa to warn him of his impending demise, ordered by Nero to commit suicide. After comforting his household and saying his farewells, Seneca prepares the bath in which he'll die. We learn of his death in the next scene, as Nero and the poet Lucan engage in a drunken song contest praising Poppaea's beauty, while Ottone, still madly in love with Poppaea, wonders how he could ever have been angry enough to think that he could kill her. Meanwhile, Empress Octavia has had enough and orders Ottone to kill her rival Poppaea, disguised as a woman, otherwise she'll have him tortured to death. Ottone asks Drusilla for help, and she agrees to dress him in her clothes. Poppaea, meanwhile, rejoices at having manipulated Nero into decreeing Seneca's death. She prays to the goddess of love to help her in her ambitions, and she dozes in the garden as Arnalta sings a lullaby. Cupid does indeed come to Poppaea's aid, arriving in the garden to prevent Ottone from killing her and announcing that he'll crown Poppaea empress this very day. So here's the second act of L'Incoronazione di Poppaea with La Veneziana, directed from the harpsichord by Davide Pozzi.
Romitaggio a pensieri delizie all'intelletto che discorre e contempla le immagini celesti sotto le forme ignobili e terrene. A te l'anima mia, lieta, lieta se viene. E fugge dal tesoro che insolente e superba fa della mia pazienza anatomia. Qui tra le verdi le fronde m'assido in grembo della pace mia. Per amico del cielo in questa solitaria chiostra visitarti io vorrei, e quando mai le visite divine io meritai, la sovrana virtù di cui sei fiero deifica i mortali, e perciò son da te ben meritate le celesti ambasciate. Pallade a te mi manda e ti annunzia vicino all'ultima ora di questa frale vita, e al passaggio all'eterna ed infinita.
Corvo.
già gran tempo ch'io porto il seno armato contro i colpi del fato. La notizia del secolo in cui vivo forastiera non giunge alla mia mente. Se mi arrechi la morte, non mi chieder perdono. Rido mentre mi rechi un sì bel dono.
Nerone!
Non più, non più!
A te mi manda!
Non più! Tor s'inteso! Et obbedisco ora.
E come intendi tu, pria, ch'io m'esprima?
La forma del tuo dire e la persona che a me ti manda son due contrassegni minacciosi e crudeli del mio fatal destino. Già son indovino. Nerone a me t'invia a imponermi la morte. Vanne, vanne, vattene ormai. Se parli a Nerone avanti sera, ch'io son morto e sepolto, mi dirai.
Sangue innocente io vo che va. Respira gloria, gloria, respira gloria, 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 g ragiona orribile.
Di carne, di pane.
politica mia già poco d'ora m'indussero a pensare d'uccidere, a pensare, d'uccidere. Poppea, ah, poi pensai, parlai d'ucciderti, mio il mio genio perverso, rifiutai gli affetti che un tempo mi donasti, piegò, cadì, proruppe un pensier sì, detestando il reo. Cangiatemi quest'anima deforme, datemi un altro spirito meno impuro per pietà vostra. O dei, rifiuto, l'intelletto che discorre in mie ali, che pensò sanguinare ed infernale d'uccidere il mio bene. E di svieni, amor che ci si scellerata a memoria di rimembrando. Sprezzami quanto sai, odiami quanto vuoi, voglio essere clizia ai soli degli occhi tuoi, voglio essere clizia al sol degli occhi tuoi. Amarò senza spegni, a dispetto, del fuoco, la mia delizia, amarti disperato. Sia mia delizia, amarti disperato.
Che uccida chi?
di parole costumate. Ah, che pena mortal mi onda
discorri da te.
Discorro, discorro il modo più cauto e più sicuro d'un'impresa si grande. Oh ciel, oh ciel, oh dei, in questo punto estremo ricoglietemi i giorni e i spiriti miei.
Che mormori!
Fa voti alla parola, che mi doni attitudine a servirti.
E perché l'ombra tua, quanto più presta sia tanto più grata, precipita l'indugi.
Sì tosto da morire, sì tosto da morire.
Ma che frequenti soliloqui son questi, ti protesta, ti protesta l'interità il mio sdegno. E se non dai veloce al maggior segno, pagherai o pagherai le pigrizia con la testa.
Se non lo saprò,
cangia, cangia vestiti, ame la muliebre ti ricopra, e con frode opportuna, sagace secotona, accendi da cerca d'opra.
Fare non posso in un momento il genio innamorato e l'arti del carnefice spietato.
Se tu non m'obbedisci, se tu non m'obbedisci,
cibo che col sangue
saprà che è un cimiterio andante.
Non ti lagnar così, sei fresca, 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 fresca ancora. Non è, non è il sol che tramonta, se ben passata le vermiglie aurore.
Geloso
di Pompeo.
No, no,
di Pompeo. Felice
comando, immergerde nel seno questo mio rango, per ricoprir me stesso in misfatto sì grande. Io vorrei le tue vesti,
tu dovessi la bella ti darò,
se occultarmi farò, vivremo poi uniti sempre, sempre in dilettosi amori. Se morir converrammi nell'idio abitoso pianto, dammi esequie, oh, Drusilla, se dovrò putitivo scampare, l'ira, l'ira immortale di chi comanda, soccorri, soccorri a mie sventure.
Le vesti e le vene ti darò volentieri, volentieri, te darò volentieri, volentieri.
Andiam mio mai, con alto stupore, il tuo potrò.
Sempre sulle nozze canzoneggiando vai,
d'altro rimane con me, non penso mai, non penso mai, non penso mai.
Il più inquieto affetto è la pazza ambizione, ma se arrivi agli scettri, alle corone, non ti scordar, non ti scordar di me, tieni appresso, appresso di te. Non ti scordar giammai dei cortigiani, perché in due cose sole Giove è reso impotente e non può far che in cielo entri la morte, né che la fede mai si trovi in corte. E non dubitar, non dubitar che me sarai sempre la stessa, e non fia mai che sia altro che te la segretaria mia. Amor,
chiudere gli occhi alla quiete.
oltre gli spazi usati, a risvegliarmi i piani e concedere l'ingresso nel giardino fuor Catrusilla o ad altra confidenza.
Adagiati Poppea, acquietati anima mia, sarai ben custodita. Oblivion so
avanti, avanti, vagheggiate, vagheggiate, il miracolo nuovo è luminoso, è luminoso il dì, siccome ne suone, eppur vedete, addormentato il sole.
Dorme l'incauta, dorme
Oh!
So, Cupid's intervention has prevented Ottone from killing Poppaea on the orders of the Empress Octavia. And the God of Love has promised to make Poppaea Empress in Octavia's place. You've just heard the second act of Monteverdi's opera The Coronation of Poppaea from the production at this year's Schwetzingen Festival with La Veneziana directed by Davide Pozzi, with bass Salvo Vitale as Seneca, bass baritone Davide Benetti as Mercury, tenor Riccardo Pisani as Liberto, and sopranos Vittoria Giacobazzi and Lucia Cortese as Damigella and Valletto, the flirting servants. Cortese also sang Cupid at the end. Nero is sung by mezzo Giuseppina Bridelli, the poet Lucano by tenor Luca Dordolo, Octavia by mezzo Zenia Maia, Ottone by countertenor Raffaele Pei, Drusilla by soprano Silvia Rosato, and Nutrice by tenor Alessio Tozzi. Now, Hannah French, the vocal casting is always an issue with operas of this period, mid-16th century Italy. And here we've got a mezzo as Emperor Nero. We've got another mezzo as the Empress Octavia, husband and wife. Vocal gender stereotyping, if I can call it that, was a little bit different then, wasn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And as you say, it works having Nero as a mezzo-soprano because your option really is a castrato, and that's obviously not an option these days. Countertenors are capable, more than capable, of performing this now. But, you know, the getting that timbre just right is absolutely crucial. And, you know, if Poppaea and Nero are singing, "I can no more longer live apart from you than a point can be dismembered," and they end in a unison, you want it to end in a unison. You don't want there to be any instance where that kind of effect is lost because Nero's role is transposed below Poppaea's. So it's always going to be difficult because you have to, ultimately, you have to reconcile Nero's parts being played by a woman.
And you've got to have enough difference of character, enough distinctiveness of character for the roles to be separable when you're just listening as we are on the radio. Yeah. Ottone in this production is a countertenor. Originally would have been a castrato, that one?
Most likely. And yet, when La Veneziana recorded this back in 2010, they used a mezzo on that role then. So it just shows the interchangeability and that any company might change their mind over which they would like to use at any time.
There's an economical aspect to this as well, because the original Venetian production used role doubling, as we're hearing with some of the roles in this performance, allowing the opera to be staged with just 11 singers, which financially makes a great deal of sense, doesn't it, for Carnival?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they knew what they were about, didn't they?
So how much has performance practice changed around Monteverdi's operas since it started being revived? I know some people tend to start thinking about Michael Tippett at Morley College in 1948 with this one, but mostly since the 1960s, I suppose, from our
yes.
point of view.
I mean, Vincent Dandy in 1905 is his concert version, and then his staged version in 1908. What that must have been like.
I wish we could hear.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, Glyndebourne really is the silver thread that goes all the way through the revival. 1962, Raymond Leopard, and then after that, bringing out his edition, a large orchestra very much of its own time.
You're dealing with those kinds of performances with, to some extent, although, you know, this is the beginnings of the historically informed and eventually the period instrument movements involved, but you're dealing with the conventions of the big opera houses, aren't you? And
wow.
That comes with certain expectations, vocally particularly.
It does, vocally and instrumentally. So these large orchestras, because actually, could anybody believe that a relatively large cast only had a continuo line to accompany it? So, you know, even when period performance gets underway, there are interpreters who believe that there was artistic license to bring in other instruments. You know, Monteverdi was obviously well-versed and wrote incredibly well for brass instruments. Emmanuel Lahim brings in percussion. Why not? But actually, there's no contemporary evidence for any of that. So when we think about Venice and how fiscally prudent or business-minded they were, then that would be fine. You could have, you know, your forest of Citeroni necks coming out of the pit, and that would be sufficient. But, you know, Mantua and the Gonzaga family, for whom Monteverdi was using all of the brass instruments, was a different world away from this. So to bring them into Poppaea is, we could perhaps see it as a bit of a misnomer.
Right. So if you think about how much has changed in the last 20 or 25 years when we've been dealing with historically informed performance and period instruments, what to you have been the key progressions, the biggest improvements in the way we think about this kind of repertoire?
I think it's the confidence to pare it back and to actually just say, we've been left a continuo line, what can we do with the continuo line? Bring in so many different combinations of instruments. Even if we bring in hurdy-gurdies and guitars and harps and chitarrones and an organ, which we probably didn't have an organ in Venice, but the sound world that that brings to a continuo line can work wonders within this score. So that's been the driving force of new interpretations. That alongside the use of countertenors. You know, William Christie's production with Daniel Denis and Philip Jaruski from the Teatro de Madrid in 2010, it just opens up new sounds, new possibilities for working with what is actually a very small, short score.
And just the fact that we know it better, it's more familiar, it gives performers and music directors confidence and greater flexibility. And we have better trained singers and musicians, people who can improvise, people who can ornament. And that makes an immense difference as well, doesn't it?
It does, because so much of this was an oral tradition. You know, the Italians were criticised when they started writing out ornamentation and figuration because it meant they hadn't learnt it properly. And that, for us, is one of the greatest barriers in period performance. And that has taken time to recreate, to experiment with, to find confidence with, and to just feel freed from the notation in order to express these emotions.
So where would you file this particular performance from La Veneziana? Because it's interesting that we have their recording, which was made under a different director, Claudio Cavina, but their performance has evolved as well, hasn't it? And presumably continues to do so.
It has, and perhaps it's unfair to compare a live recording with their deliberations and the great pains they went to put it onto CD in the first place. You can tell that it's a jumping off point, and you can tell that they had ideas there that, you know, they've done their research, to put it mildly, and that they're taking that now and they're finding freedom in their own interpretation too.
So we know it was first performed in Venice in the last year of Monteverdi's life. How should we evaluate it alongside his earlier operas? I know we've got the problem of the possible many hands involved in its creation, but if we put that on one side, what's your reaction to it in context of his other operas?
I think taking into account all of those considerations, it's an amazingly homogeneous score. It's a seamless continuation of recitative, aria, arioso, ensemble, ritornellos. And whether you include then elements of other composers and you carry on adding to this compendium score or not, it's hard to believe that he wasn't the driving force behind this, because it seems a very logical continuation of his own ideas. Monteverdi serves the text with music which, for any cynicism, for any difficulty, brings it back to human emotion and a way that we identify with it beautifully.
Now, Hannah, I can't believe we've got this far through the opera and we haven't yet mentioned the final duet, that glorious ending to Poppea, the love duet between Nero and Poppea. And I find it hard to believe that it isn't by Monteverdi, but I know the scholarship's changed on this one. Where's the finger pointing at the moment?
Well, you want it to be by Monteverdi, don't you? Because it has become so established. The finger often points at Benedetto Ferrari, because the text of that duet also appears in his Il Pastor Reggio, and he was both a librettist and a composer. So likelihood could have been him, but Sacrati and Cavalli, you know, the fingers wave at them too.
All estimable composers. We know any of them could have done it. We'd like it to be Monteverdi. Whoever it's by, it's a wonderful thing and a glorious moment. Finally, is it possible to quantify the influence of Monteverdi's Poppea on the next generation of composers?
In some respects, the work itself answers that question. If it is a compendium of works by the next generations themselves, I keep thinking of it a little like a Caravaggio, and the great master sits at the back and the apprentices all work in front of him and work on the final product, then yes, of course they take this on. And when you see what happens in Venice throughout the century, Antonio Sartorio, Giovanni Legrenzi, you can see this continuum, this idea that eventually by the time we get to Vivaldi, the arias and the recits have become more detached, and this idea of a sequence has been broken up somewhat. But yes, I mean, this is he's laying the foundation for what would happen, certainly in Italy, from this point forward.
Well, Hannah French, thanks so much for your expert interventions as we listen to this performance from this year's Schwetzingen Festival. At the end of the second act, Ottone's assassination attempt had failed, thwarted by Cupid. Poppea has been promised the Empress's throne. Drusilla thinks the plot succeeded, though, and only realises the truth when she's arrested and brought before Nero for questioning about the attempt on Poppea's life. Threatened with torture, Drusilla confesses. Atone was wearing her clothes, after all, and she can protect the man she loves. When Drusilla is sentenced to death, Otone confesses that he alone is guilty, acting on the orders of the Empress Octavia. Nero decrees that all three of them are to be exiled. Poppaea arrives, the way clear now for all her ambitions to be realised. As Poppaea's confidant, Arnalta, rejoices at her mistress's triumph, the devastated Octavia sets out to sea alone, leaving family, friends and country behind her. The opera's final scene is the crowning of Poppaea as empress, and Venus descends to acclaim the victory of Cupid, her son. The opera ends with Nero and Poppaea's great love duet. Act 3 of Monteverdi is the coronation of Poppaea, with La Veneziana, directed by Davide Pozzi.
Dispensa a caritare, allora il gran mi spatta.
sforza a dir quello, quello che tacer vorrei. Sopra me stessa colgo la sentenza mortal del monumento. Oh, voi che il mondo vi chiamate amici, specchiatevi in me questi del vero amico, son gli uffici.
Che cinguetti ribalda,
che vaneggi assassina,
che parli tra di freche, contrastano in me stessa con fiera concorrenza.
Costui da portare salutive le bugie. piace.
Signor, signor, non son punito, non son punito, no, non son punito. Anzi beato, anzi beato, anzi beato. La virtù di costei sarà ricchezza e gloria. La virtù di costei sarà ricchezza e gloria ai giorni miei.
Or su, finiamola, andate la valora.
Thank you.
Thank you.
pianti ai passi, insegnando pietà ai tronchi, ai sassi. Repicate, repicate, repicate oggi noi, perverse genti, allontanatevi, allontanatevi a morte, dagli amati liri, ai, ai,
onde mi collocasti. strana Augusta.
Con il consenso
universal, versal, versal, versal,
versal,
da terra sa terra.
A te l'Europa, a te l'Europa, il mar che cinge e serva.
Questo imperio felice ora consacra e dona e dona questa del mondo imperiale.
Sacra e dona,
ora
consacra il mondo imperiale,
ora
I gaze upon you, I rejoice in you. The great love duet that ends Monteverdi's opera Incoronazione di Poppea. The title leaving us in no doubt as to the eventual outcome, the ultimate mid-16th century spoiler, perhaps. The cast was led by soprano Emanuela Galli as Poppea and mezzo Giuseppina Bridelli as Nero, with Xenia Meyer as Empress Octavia, Raffaele Pei as Ottone and Silvia Rosato as Drusilla. Arnalto was sung by Alberto Allegrezza, with the rest of the cast as the chorus in the final scene, and La Veneziana directed from the harpsichord by Davide Pozzi. Hannah French, now we've heard it, that final duet, one of the crowning glories of Monteverdi's output. Possibly. Does it really matter in the end?
It doesn't matter, does it? I mean, our moral compass might be completely adrift, but we've been seduced into identifying with, frankly, these villains. I mean, the audience of the time, they knew their history well enough to know that there was going to be a grisly outcome for Poppea and Nero later. But this performance particularly persuades us, because they know that we know it, and then they're able to stretch it even further. It's practically swung. And through that, it forces us to confront both the suffering that they've caused and also acknowledge the humanity of this pair of villains. They're anticipating each other's phrases, and they're working as the ultimate partnership.
And the music is just magical. It makes it so beautiful for us at the end. Hannah, thanks so much for your company. Thanks to the European Broadcasting Union for providing this recording of Poppea from this year's Schwetzingen Festival in Germany. So lust and ambition have conquered all. And with that dubious moral message from mid-16th century Italy, let's continue with the rest of this evening's programmes here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, I don't think that's the message we'll necessarily be reinforcing tonight. That was Andrew McGregor. I mentioned at the beginning that Monteverdi's L'Incoronazione di Poppea is one of seven operas featured in a new exhibition at the V&A. It's called Opera, Passion, Power and Politics. And during the course of this autumn, we're going to be broadcasting all seven of those operas in full on Radio 3. There's lots of information about the BBC opera season. If you'd like to know more, do go to the BBC Arts homepage and follow the links to music. Meanwhile, there's more opera on Radio 3 next Thursday when Handel's Rinaldo is our opera matinee. Penny Gore introduces a performance conducted by Christopher Hogwood with the Academy of Ancient Music. The American countertenor David Daniels takes the title role. The cast also includes Cecilia Bartoli and Gerald Finley. Rinaldo begins at 2 o'clock next Thursday afternoon.
From poet to punk rocker, the crime writer Ian Rankin recalls his many youthful ambitions.
You know, we think of life as a river flowing, but it's a bit more stuttering than that. There are kind of moments where your life can change. I phoned Mum for my higher results. Economics C. This is a bad news thing. It has deflated my opinion of myself as an economist. You know, that was a moment that changed my whole life.
My Teenage Diary, Ian Rankin Special.
I mean, there aren't many 17-year-olds who have an opinion of themselves as an economist.
Next Thursday evening at 6:30 on BBC Radio 4.